The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be back here on Tuesday morning. I want to start with telling you a story. It's an Australian man who became a Buddhist monk, Ajahn Brahm, went to Thailand for quite a few years to study with a famous master, Ajahn Chah. And after he had been there for a few years, Ajahn Chah said, you know, it's time for you to go back to your country and teach. So he went back to Australia, got together with a few Buddhist monks, and they decided they were going to construct a monastery. They raised enough money to get the materials, but that was it. No construction workers. So the monks were so motivated that they decided, well, we'll just do it somehow. Ajahn Brahm, with his Cambridge education, had not really prepared him for doing construction work, but he decided he was going to do it as part of his meditation practice. So he went about learning how to align bricks and do the mortar and worked hard for several days. Then decided to take a step back, much to his horror, noticed that there were two bricks that were really crooked. So he was very chagrined and went to the abbot and said, look, I made a mistake. This wall is not acceptable. Please, would you allow me to tear it down? And the abbot said, no, I'm sorry. We don't have time for this. So he said, well, at least allow me to just file down the two bricks that are crooked. No, 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 said the abbot, we really don't have time for this. The wall is acceptable. So you know how it is when we have to live with our mistakes. He was not very happy with the acceptable wall. Time went by and, you know, visitors would come to the monastery, and Ajahn Brahm actually would make a point when he would give a tour not to take the visitors along this wall. He was embarrassed. There was actually shame there about this wall. But one fine day, he was a little bit distracted talking with this particular visitor. And before he knew, there they were in front of this wall. And the next thing he hears is the man says, what a fine wall. Who built it? So he just kind of shrank back and he said, well, me, but did you forget your glasses at home? Can't you see that this wall has some very crooked bricks? And the man very quietly looks at him and says, yes, I do see those two crooked bricks, but I also see the 998 bricks that are perfectly aligned. So Ajahn Brahm tells that hearing this comment, he was ready for it. He had kept this shame locked inside himself for quite a while. And hearing this comment, it's like he had an insight and realized, I have been putting all this emphasis on the two bricks I put wrong and totally discounting the wonderful work that I have done without having had any training. So I don't know how this story resonates with you, but when I heard it for the first time, I really could resonate. Because I too, in the past, have had this tendency to focus so much of what's not right, of what could be better. And (clears throat) I also had this unconscious belief that if I went at judging myself in a very strict and thorough way, I would become a better person. And the practice taught me otherwise. It's very liberating. What I also found very liberating, and this is the unique way that this practice gets expressed in the West. You know, the practice, the Dharma has gone to many countries, and it takes a different flavor, form in different cultures. And in this culture, I would say the emphasis, that the influence that has had is science and psychology. So I found it very liberating to find out that it wasn't just me that tended to emphasize my weaknesses, but that is actually something that the brain does naturally. So, whoa, this is very wonderful to understand that this is a natural way for the brain to protect us. It's a way to keep us safe. So the brain is saying, look, pay attention to what you did wrong so you don't repeat this mistake again. So then we really remember our mistakes much more than what we did right. But I find it kind of touching that the reason why we do it is because we want to take care of ourselves. We can say that we are the results of many generations who have really paid attention to their weaknesses. And that, therefore we're here, therefore we've survived. So not only do we remember and stress our weaknesses, but also we can detect what's not right faster than what's right. You know, from experiments, if you're shown faces that are happy, and then one face that is worried or scared, you detect that much faster. So there is, again, you know, this vigilant brain trying to keep us safe. Rick Hansen writes that our brain is like Velcro with a negative and like Teflon with a positive. Mark Twain says, I am an old man and have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened. It's great, isn't it? And so there again, you know, is how much time we spent worrying because we want to take care of ourselves. We want to make sure that when we find ourselves in that situation, we somehow will be protected. So I find it very important to bring kindness to ourselves when we notice, okay, this is something that we do, we all do it, we want to be safe, it's natural. And departing from that, now what can we do knowing that so that the balance doesn't tip too much into the negative, so that as we grow older, we, in our storage, in our brain, we don't accumulate way many more negative, worrisome thoughts, memories than the positive ones. And here is where we can see how the practice and science neurology answers these questions. You know, can we actually do something about this natural occurrence? I can tell you from the very beginning, yes, we can, which I think is tremendously promising. I'm sure you've all heard about neuroplasticity, which means we can, no matter what our tendencies are, personality, through habit, through discipline, change this balance of focusing on the negative. But of course, we have to work at it. And this is exactly what monks and nuns have been doing in Asia for centuries. Basically, science is now telling us what monks and nuns have known for centuries. And they've known it from their own experience, paying attention of how they feel from meditating, from paying attention, bringing mindfulness to everything they do in their daily lives. The Dhammapada says, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupt mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So from some experiments, we know that in order to perfect something, we have to spend 10,000 hours at it, which amounts to about 3 hours a day for 10 years, more or less. So if we think about meditation, we could get a little discouraged and say, whoa, 10 years, 3 hours a day, good luck. But the good news is that we actually, and I'm sure you've already noticed, we can actually tell the difference even meditating 20 minutes a day regularly. You might know that from the work of Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, his mindfulness-based stress reduction, the reason he has made his course 2 months long is because this is the minimum amount of time that it takes to actually notice some structural change in the brain if you meditate every day. So if we were to get right now some electrodes put in our brain and we get a reading of our brain, and then we commit to meditating 45 minutes every day for 2 months, at the end of the 2 months we get again this imaging of our brain, there would be a change. There would actually be a structural change in our brain. So this is very, very, very promising. 45 minutes is not such a long time. And most of us are doing this already. So the way neurology speaks about this is we can imagine, I make an image, that what happens in our brain with every single thought, as transient, as insignificant as it can be, or word that we speak, is that it leaves us a trace. We can imagine like a spring rain coming down a sandy hillside. It's just this little trace that leaves behind. When we truly understand this, how something immaterial like a thought leaves something material behind, the residue in our brain, then I think, or I would hope, that we become tremendously motivated to be excellent guardians at the sense doors. What comes in through our sight, through our ears, through our taste, through our smell, and through our thinking, of course. If you remember that in Buddhism we speak of 6 senses, thinking being the 6th. So then we much quicker will, even if the thought has stickiness, we will be motivated, if it's an unskillful thought, to pull it out from its root. Out. This is not helping us right now. So if we look at the list that neurologists give you of what reshapes the brain, what practices reshape our brain, is a direct correlation with our practice. And of course, at the top is meditation. They list also focusing on the breath, emphasizing exhalation, the exhalation if there is anxiety, if exhalation is longer, brings a little bit more calm, mindfulness of the body. There are just a couple that are different. One of them that I found kind of intriguing is that touching the lips apparently is a way of bringing some calmness. Apparently it activates the parasympathetic nervous system. So I wouldn't recommend it if you haven't washed your hands, especially now with the cold season. But you know, I guess there is something to it. Another thing that they list is imagery, which in our tradition we don't stress, but you know, in the Tibetan tradition they stress a lot. No? But so if imagery comes up naturally for you in your meditation, you know, and you need that grounding, stay with it for a while if you notice that is helping your brain to settle. So they talk about connecting with people that can support you. We talk about sangha, cultivating a sense of safety. Well, definitely. This is something that we offer here. And being mindful of fear itself. Well, that's definitely something we learned, to be mindful about emotions. It's a very important aspect. So I want to shift now over to a specific aspect of how to cultivate this brain, this mind state that gives us tranquility and well-being. A very important part, which is what we started with, is the stories we tell ourselves and others. So we saw here with Ajahn Brahm, you know, this is a story he was telling himself, you know, terrible, how could I do this? I mean, if I can build a wall that is straight, how can I even dream of becoming enlightened? You know, this is the kind of monologue that we produce ourselves. So learning how to be aware of our stories and taking the golden opportunity of telling our stories skillfully when we are with a friend, with a loved one, and we're invited to tell our story, to realize this is a lovely opportunity for me to reshape my inner world. And I want to give you an example that I found particularly useful and transcending in the way it happened with an individual. I was part of a study group, and we did this experiment because we were studying about how can we transform ourselves, our stories, by creating a specific kind of context and by telling our story in a way that uses right speech, where there is right listening, and several other elements that I hope that we can put together after I tell you the story. Hopefully coming from all of you to see, well, what is there that needs to come together so that when we tell a story, especially a painful memory, which we all have, when we bring it out, what needs to happen in order to get ourselves one step freer from this painful memory, as opposed to making that groove of pain deeper. So I want to tell you the story that this woman told as if she were speaking, because I want it to be as much as the way she said it, and we're going to call her Claire. This is how she put it. I was about 6 years old, and I wanted to learn to ride my new bike that I had received from my parents. It was a beautiful, bright red bike. More than anything, I wanted to ride my bike like my big brother. I asked him if he would teach me how, and he agreed. I got on my new bike, and my brother helped me steady myself by holding the seat and the handlebars. While I was pedaling with all my force and was trying hard to keep my balance, my brother decided to play a prank on me. As a car drove by, he pushed my bike towards the moving car. I was so frightened. Before hitting the car, I lost my balance and fell hard on the cement. The pain was intense. Claire made a pause. We all remained in silence, acknowledging the very painful memory. This in turn allowed her to feel safe and supported. So now, with tears in her eyes, she continued, "I think that since then I lost the trust in my brother." And she paused again. And then something emerged that not only surprised us, but her. She added, "I am convinced that because of the bicycle accident, I was unable to have children." Claire had never told this to anybody. Not even her husband knew about this. So we paused again, sensing that Claire had accessed a part of her memory that she wasn't even aware that she had put together. So feeling all of the emotional pain of what she had perceived as treason, and accessing the unconscious association of not having been able to conceive, Claire was connecting with the explicit memories. So something very powerful happened for Claire as she unearthed this very painful memory, but she did it in a skillful manner in an appropriate context. The feeling I had when she told this story is that it's almost like a chemical reaction had happened when this memory that had been kept in its hermetic container had been opened and the contact with the oxygen had made it transform. Now, this sharing was powerful as it was, and I could tell that something had shifted for her. But what was even more interesting was that months later, I saw her again, and the moment was right, so I asked her, would you mind telling me, have you had any afterthoughts about this very intense experience that we shared? And what she said was that she felt like a shadow that had been with her had lifted as a result of this sharing. She also expressed that having shared or unearthed this memory and seen it from the perspective of a mature woman, and also supported by her practice, which of course influenced the way she told the story, that it had completely given her a different perspective on it, that she had understood that her brother had really not tried to harm her, but that he was just being a mischievous little boy, completely unconscious of what he was doing. And he just thought it was funny to scare his sister. She also understood why she had felt so distant from her brother for, seemed to her, like her whole life. And that since our exchange, she said, I feel like I can be more genuine with my brother. And for the first time, I feel compassion for his weaknesses or for his difficulties, because he has some difficulties. She also said, I realized that there's no medical evidence that the fall and how I hit myself had something to do that I was never able to conceive. Therefore, why should I store in my memory, why should I store it in a way that causes more pain? You know, so this is making ourselves conscious that we have a choice of how do we put it away in our mind. I was particularly touched when Claire said to me that this very intimate experience she had shared with us had felt for her like a moment of giving birth. Now, for somebody who really wanted to give birth and never could, I thought that was particularly touching. So, what I'd like to do now is let us take a couple minutes in silence, and I'd like for us to put our heads together and share what is it that, what elements are there that made this possible, this transformation possible, or for ourselves, you know, if there is something that comes up that for us is important around this topic. Thank you. So, I'd like to hear from you, especially thinking from the perspective of the practice. What elements are or were present in this example that allowed this transformation, allowed this individual to liberate herself from some suffering, which is really what our practice is all about? Think of, for example, about right speech. What elements were there within the right speech that allowed this to happen? Yes, thank you.
Well, it comes to mind for me kind of space, so it's not so tight and reactive. You know, because when you're tight and reactive, you just stuff just comes out. You know,
yes.
If you have more space, you can pause and you're more relaxed. So your speech kind of follows that, I think.
Yes, thank you. That's right. You know, this aspect of reaction. Imagine if Claire had told the story full of hatred, portraying her as the victim. Then what we're doing, really, is adding more wood to the fire of anger and resentment. And instead of stepping into less suffering, she's stepping into more suffering. So that's a very, very important aspect of how is it, you know, let's all think about it. Next time we tell a story, if we felt that somebody did us some harm, you know, how do we tell the story? Yeah, thank you. Now, what is the other side of the skillful speech? There was the speaker. And then it's like the other side of the coin. Yes.
The group in the listening, they...
Yes.
In right speech, there's some parts that talk about don't speak unnecessary things. And they gave, again, the space. As he said, they were quiet. They,
mm-hmm.
And in that, it gave her the gift of that space and time and sort of an honoring, so she felt safe to say more, and it arose naturally.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful. That's it. So it's the space that the presence that the group offers. I've heard Gil say that the person who does the listening does the loving. I find that beautiful. And it's so often, you know, that when we have attention with somebody, that one of the best gifts we can offer is to listen. So the group was there to listen. And yes, as you both said, there was the space then for us to take it in as listeners and for her to go beyond that, the one memory. The main memory, which was the accident, and then the explicit memory, which was kind of in the blind spot for her, that got access because there was that space there.
So one thing I noticed was she got to tell the story and the whole story, not just this terrible thing happened, but that she was excited to learn how to ride a bike and to share it with her brother. So just being heard and telling Mm-hmm. That whole story seemed important.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I guess that's why when I wanted to communicate this story with you, I actually wanted to say it with her voice. Just kind of trying to remember the kinds of words she used. How about emotions? What would you say happened in relation to the whole range of emotions?
Well, certainly forgiveness is the main one, a kind of a uncontraction and letting go. But I guess she, in a way, she stopped being stuck in a story, is the phrase I hear a lot here. She stopped seeing herself as a victim of circumstance and just saw it as one of the many just bad things that just happen to everybody, I guess.
Yeah, thank you. You know, you're touching on something that that's an interesting topic related to skillful speech, and that is, when do you tell a story that is really charged? Do you notice that sometimes you are still so caught by it that if you tell the story, you get swooshed up with it again, like a wave that takes you and just tumbles you around. So then you realize, I don't have the space yet. I still get completely caught. So thank you for making that comment, because that reminded me, you know, of this that I've noticed in myself. It's like, okay, I don't have any perspective yet. So, any ideas? What do we do when we're still caught by it? And telling it would again. And it's like we fall into that you can just feel how the emotions are wringing you and you're just caught by it. And you know you're going to get that groove deeper that takes you into the suffering as opposed to liberating you. Any ideas? Yes.
I'm not sure if I can address exactly what you just were saying, but what I find is that when I become intensely emotional about something like what happened to this little girl, that I become really obsessed. My thinking becomes really obsessed in my head. And to me, it actually helps if I can talk to somebody else about it to kind of get a different perspective and them to kind of open up the way I, you know, am stuck. Because I'm not really sure, I'm really interested in hearing how maybe a different way to address it. But for me, if I talk to, you know, somebody that loves me and says, well, let's look at it this way, and then I can break that cycle that's so intense.
Yeah. I think sharing it with somebody who is a trusting, loving individual is essential. You know, I mean, now that's an essential part in the story that I told you, right? That she had a container where she felt trusted, she felt accepted, she felt there was loving kindness there. So that's an essential part. Yes.
Over the weekend, is that on? Over the weekend, I heard a reading, listened to a reading that referred to an old TV character, Joe Friday, the detective, who used to say, just the facts, just the facts. And sometimes that is all one needs to leave the emotion out of an old story. That is, and so at least I don't know what all went on in this woman, Claire's, processing of this story over many, many years. Yeah. But as you told it, she stuck to the facts. She talked about what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the closest I heard to real emotion was during the telling of the story was the belief was still alive that maybe her infertility was caused by the accident.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, she was pretty neutral. And that's a hard place to get to.
Yes. Yes.
But I liked the way it was told. Just having heard it would help me remember to tell it again, to tell my stories in a more neutral way.
Wonderful, thank you. Yes, that's a very important element, and I'm so glad you mentioned it. So it's very helpful that we get the facts, that we just get the facts there, because if somebody's really listening to us, they'll be able, as you mentioned, to give us a slightly different perspective or a wider perspective, because at least they have the structure to go by. But then, as you said, it takes a while to get to that place and to get the emotion so they're not at, you know, like a pot boiling with boiling water. So what do we do if we're going to tell this story, as you said, and because we find some respite by being able to share it, can we mention the emotion? Is there a way to be, what does the Dharma teach us? Is there a way to bring the emotions out in a skillful way? What would you say? Remember, part of an essential element of mindfulness is genuineness, honesty with what is true in the moment. And in the moment, there can be rage. And it's hard to be with rage, but rage is present. So is there a way to say, this is what's present, and not be toxic? I see people nodding. Yes, there is a way, and that is tremendously liberating. So we don't have to become the anger. We don't have to say that jerk and start insulting the other person. But just to look at us with compassion and say, you know, I feel like I'm burning inside. This is so painful. Being angry just makes me want to jump out of my skin. Could you help me hold this? Imagine the response you get when you say it this way, or if you tell your partner the story and you are the anger. And I'm just furious because of this son of a... The other person kind of pulls back a little. It's like, ooh. And you don't get the response that you wish you would get. Does it make sense? So yeah, we can. I mean, we definitely are given in the Dharma the tools to be true to what's happening and to be able to hold all of the emotions and to slowly work to the place where we can be with our story in a way that we begin to free ourselves from the suffering. But it takes time. Yes.
This is very difficult for me. I know that this really touched something in me because I sort of blanked out. I come from extreme abuse. Mm-hmm. I was raped for years. I was beaten. I was neglected. Blah, 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 blah. And it's really hard for me to say blah, 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 because I lived in such terror that I dissociated. Mm-hmm. And I now have PTSD, which is what is being treated, what I'm being treated for. So you're talking about story, and I have a problem with that because they're sort of like, well, there, or maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm too new at this. There are stories or facts that you can't just tell of as, here's my story, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the stories, because there were years and years of them, there is such a maelstrom of fear and rage and self-loathing and self-neglect. Da 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 da. How are you supposed to approach that kind of story?
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing this.
And I want to apologize because I'm not trying to bring anybody down, but sometimes when I'm working on this stuff, I have a cousin who was a severe alcoholic, and she used to talk about, she never understood what life was like for, and this is her term, the normies, because mm-hmm. she was an alcoholic. She also came from an abusive childhood, not like mine, but mm-hmm. Her mother was my mother's sister.
Yeah.
So in a way, sometimes when I do this stuff, when I do the readings and stuff like that, I get confused because it's like, I feel like it's all addressed to the normies.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do with
yeah.
all the stuff.
So, you know, first I really want to thank you very much for having the courage to speak up. I can tell, and I know this is not easy. Second, I just want to say I really feel with you. This is enormous what you are carrying, and it's not something. Let me back up. Don't feel like you have to apologize. No, you enrich us all by bringing all of yourself, not just the part that fits a norm. We can learn from you. We can learn from each other. And we have loads to carry, and it takes a lot of compassion, I would say, for the main element. I'd say if you can engage in the practice in a way that can help you cultivate compassion in order to begin holding the enormity. I've known of people in the practice who've worked with such extreme cases as yours, but there's a very important aspect of just being very patient, accepting of all of yourself over and over. No, you're not different. This is part of life. And being in touch with the feelings the way you are now is a way of healing. You know, you shared in a way that allows you to feel the depth of the pain, and that's a little step forward. You can free yourself from it.
I feel in having found the mindfulness meditation and in having found the center that, and I have finally found a place where there are people who are striving to be, in terms of right actions, right thinking, is even in the midst of all of that, and I'm talking about when I was very, very little, mm-hmm. it's what I've always been striving for, what I always have been trying for, because I do know that sometimes as a child, in the midst of a beating, deep, deep inside me, I would say to myself, addressing whoever was inflicting the punishment, I don't care how much you beat me, you can beat me, you can beat me, you can beat me, you can't make me change, I won't be like you. Mm. And I used to think that was just my obstinacy, and that I, as a child, I just thought, you know, that's my evil. I was so evil that I wouldn't be like them. Mm. But now, I guess I'm trying to say something more positive, is that in trying to follow and do the readings and stuff, that I do have this glimmer of hope that I can put all that behind me or aside or whatever the right mm-hmm. way is to say mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's just really, 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 really hard.
Of course. So since we're almost out of time, if I may take the thread that you presented us with of hope and know, may I ask your name?
Catherine.
And to know, Catherine, that here you have a safe container that we as Dharma practitioners cultivate loving kindness. So what I would like to suggest to all of you, please, if we could take 2 minutes to close our eyes, and we are going to do some loving kindness meditation that we are going to dedicate for Catherine. So each one in your own words, sending Catherine wishes of forgiveness for herself and the people who harmed her. Sending her strength, patience, loving kindness, and the ability to connect to immense reservoirs of compassion within yourself. Thank you.